with Mr. Roger Williams, author of my favorite fucking book, The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect. If you do not buy it by midnight tonight, I will come to your house, I will siphon the gas out of your car, and I'll burn you alive. It's a great book. That was an artistic rendition. That was not a threat. That was art, what I just did. That was art. Let's be very clear.
Right.
Very, very clear. But I've been listening to like other people's recording of my Zoom, and my audio is always absolutely fucked. It's just like this, like muffled, and it's everyone else's is crystal clear, but I don't get it because I have a microphone. I have a ball on microphone.
It's the room. It's the acoustics.
Really is the room.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear that. Yeah. You know, you've got the sound bouncing off and off the walls and coming back and in and out of phase.
Hold on, let me try something real quick. Roger, monologue real quick.
Hey, Metamorphosis Prime Intellect. Get it on Amazon.com if you need to, but if you get it from Lulu.com as a printed copy, then I make a lot more money, even though you pay the same, because then Amazon doesn't take their cut. And I normally do that when Tommy takes a whiz. I mean, you didn't think of doing this before we started the show.
Okay, turn off all air. Roger, were you monologuing, or do I need to cut that out?
I did a little. I reminded people to buy it from Lulu instead of Amazon if they wanted a paper copy.
Whatever you do, you better buy it if you want to survive.
Yeah,
artistically,
well,
artistically, I'll kill you in a rendition.
Yeah, the thing is, if you want a paper copy, it costs the same if you buy it through Amazon or if you buy it from Lulu. But if you buy it from Lulu, Amazon doesn't take their cut. They have to charge the same amount of money because of the contracts. But if you buy it directly from Lulu, I get Amazon's cut of the money. So it's like, instead of getting $1.50, I get like $6.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. Well, that's, yeah. You know, maybe one day I'll figure out this audio thing.
Well, I think your big problem is like you've got a decent microphone, and the thing is though is that your room has just like crappy acoustics.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the thing is there's a trade off. If you bring the mic closer to your mouth,
I get the
poof. Then you get the poof 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 thing.
Yeah.
Which poof 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 is this is supposed to be de-poofing that.
Yeah.
But if you know, it's like if you see in the late night shows now, everybody's doing everything with their laptops, and you get the room acoustics. You know, it's not necessarily bad because they've actually gotten pretty good at the processing these things, but it's still you're talking to your laptop.
Yeah.
Now, The other thing you'll notice is like if you look at like Lex's show, the
Lex Friedman,
you know, some podcasters like almost all radio broadcasters, they talk directly to the microphone.
Yeah.
They're not like, which means the camera is off to the side.
Yeah,
and you'll notice if you notice that. That's the case with almost all of the radio guys.
Yeah.
Lex's camera is like at a 90-degree angle. It's like it's in profile.
Yeah. Tim Dillon's is like, Tim Dillon, the comedian, his has got to be a solid 6-7 feet away. And it's up. Right. Yeah.
So this is part of, now, once you move out and get your own place and you design your own, you're able to make your own studio.
Yeah.
Then that's one of the things that you need to kind of think about is like exactly how do you want to present it? Because I notice you like to do the eye contact thing,
mm-hmm.
eye contact with the camera, with your guests, and that's not consistent. You can't do that and also do the microphone thing. So you got to kind of decide how you want to present yourself.
Yeah, like.
How you okay? So it's like, do you want it to be audio centric, which is like every fucking radio broadcaster in the world
Yeah.
who has a pod, who has a video feed, the video is looking at them from the side and they're kissing the microphone.
Yeah. Yeah, I
Okay.
never thought about that. You're right. I had never thought about that till you said that. Rogan, is it it's not facing at him. I guess I do it that way because my guests aren't in person. So I want them to like see, 'cause like right now how you see me, right? You just see my side profile, you see an old rocking chair,
Right.
an Xbox, like yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I would like to see you kissing the microphone like
Yeah.
this, sort of,
Yeah.
and you would be looking at me from the side. That's how almost all the radio shows do it. And so you kind of need to think about how do you want to do that? Now,
Yeah.
personally, I think you've done almost 300 shows. And you've made a thing of eye contact with the guests, eye contact with the viewers.
Yeah.
So, I'm abusing this microphone. This is not the way it's designed to be. This microphone really wants me to be kissing it, holding it up like an ice cream cone.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of, but I wanted to try it out.
Well, I could, it already sounds better.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it couldn't be any worse than the fucking live chat that's like 12 years old, has no muffler at all around because
Yeah.
the foam disintegrated.
Yeah.
But it had the advantage of muffling reflections because it was so close to my mouth
Yeah.
that at an appropriate volume level, the reflections from the walls in this entirely crappy acoustic environment were not that bad,
Yeah.
so now, like I said, I've heard that moving blankets make
Yeah.
really good wall hangings if you're building a home studio.
Yeah. Yeah. I think.
A girl who has a experience told me
Yeah. I think
that.
that maybe the move is just like a high quality gaming headset for me. Maybe I have to look like I'm giving a Tony Robbins seminar every episode.
And I looked the gaming headsets up too. You were right. It's like, yes, you can get a headset with a boom mic for only $300. It's,
Oh, I mean, it's an investment, right? It's
and they've got all the fucking flashing LEDs
fuck
and
that.
glamour shit and all going on. And it's like, that's not what I want
No.
here. Now, if this is working out, you'll notice I'm also wearing my Bluetooth headsets.
Yeah.
So, but it's also like I have a bowling ball over each ear.
Yeah.
So, by next week, I'll probably get myself a lighter pair of Bluetooth headsets for
Yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Just, I was like, these are the ones that I like these for listening to music though,
Yeah.
because they exclude the outside sounds really
Yeah, they're
nicely.
dope. Yeah.
But it's, not optimal for what we're doing here.
Yeah, I definitely need to get like a microphone that sits up close to me because or is close to me. Would it be a Roger podcast if I didn't turn the lights down low? That's it's TPC after dark, right? But it's because I just like I'm trying to swear less because I think it does t I've had a lot of people tell me that like, it's not that it's offensive. They're like, it's whatever, but they're like it take it's distracting.
I used to swear like a sailor myself,
Yeah.
and it's one of those things. It's like eventually you reach a point where it's like,
It loses meaning.
and it's not having the effect anymore. It's not giving
Right.
you the punch,
Right.
and it's pissing people off.
Yeah.
So it's
Yeah.
like.
Yeah. I don't care about that. It's but I listened to some of my early episodes And I was like, because the reason I never did is like I knew it sounded bad, but to me it was such a fluid part of me that by not doing it, I was going to interrupt the stream of thoughts and that would inhibit. So I would rather take swear words and a good stream of thoughts than like, just curating my words. But I've slowly toned it down over the last maybe like 100, 150 episodes.
And I have noticed that.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
And it's so that, and now I do it fluently. Now I can still kind of go on rants and stuff, and you can tactically use an F-bomb for emphasis.
Yeah,
But
well, it means more. It means more when you do, because you're not doing it all the time.
So maybe the next move is the reason why I don't like sort of kissing the microphone is because when I'm getting into a rant, I have to just sort of let it fly and I lean and blah 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 blah. But it's like maybe I can learn, just like swearing, maybe I can learn to stay right here with a rant, right?
Yeah, well, and you can do it. It's like, and
Just
like,
stay going,
well, and part of the thing that I like about this is I'm not tethered to the fucking computer anymore because I can do this. I can, reach around and do something. It's like, if I did that before, I'd yank the fucking computer off of its blocks sitting on. And you notice that it doesn't reduce the volume that much when I do it. You can tell, but it's not like I just like go out of range or anything. It's like, okay, well, it's like I'm not quite close anymore. But yeah, it's not like I'm like my neck chain around this thing. It's like you can still move around, but what you want to do is make your major delivery when you're doing like a big rant or a big reading or something like I am planning for you. Then you want to stay close to the microphone so you get the full fidelity. But yeah, it's just, I got these things. I gotta get a lighter set of headphones. I do have, my.
Roger, you're getting the originals.
Really nice, along with the microphone, my wife got these Sony headphones. Really nice headphones. You know what the problem with them is?
Little short cord. Yeah.
Yeah,
Can't do cords.
that's the fucking cord. It's even worse than the life share thing.
Can't do that. It's, you know what the move might even be? It just might be that it's not even, maybe I just need to get like a table mounted boom and just put it back here. 'Cause right now it's sitting on the laptop. So it's not much different than a laptop microphone. If I just,
You can't really see it, but this is on what used to be a desk lamp stand.
Oh no, mine is balanced on top of a history of Pixar, NASA graphic design manual from 76, legit like mint condition that my brother got me last year, and What If by Randall Munroe. So it's just stacked on all of those. So it's, yeah, but as with all things in this podcast, it's probably just gonna be this chaotic, wheels are flying off, flames are coming out the side, we're trying to hold the door in and the steering column, and eventually, somehow or another, we realize that we're at 290 episodes now, and we'll figure it out as we go. We'll make it happen. And I appreciate your patience yesterday. I was having an off day yesterday. I was like, Roger, where are you? Where are you? You're like, dude, time zone. And I took that as
I was
my,
like, I was, no, I was, I was, I was like fucking taking a nap.
oh
I mean,
yeah.
it's like, seriously, I was like, this is like, I am so like turning into an old man. I was fucking taking a nap on Saturday
Yeah,
afternoon,
there's nothing
and
wrong with
that's why
that.
I wasn't here to receive your call. I'm like, normally I would have just been here going, it's like, oh, Tommy, yeah, sure, whatever. He's like, nope, I was.
No, dude, there's nothing. To me, that was my own signal that was like, take a day off. Because I was like, Roger, where are you? And you're like, time difference. And it'd be one thing if it happened once before, but you've been a guest like 30 times now. Like, I know that I'm an hour ahead of you. And I looked at that and you just said time difference. And just those two words. And I just sat there and I was like,
take time zones. What the fuck, man?
Yeah, I just, so in my mind, I just said, take the hint. And I was like, went to bed early and, you know, just got some sleep and was like, okay. You know, sometimes when you fuck up something that simple, sometimes it's like, close the laptop.
Well, that makes us even, though, because I did that to you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. That did. So that's our canary. When one of us forgets that we're an hour apart, which is as basic as first names, that's when it's like, hey, man, how you doing? Everything good at home? Fuck. I guess you're right, right? That's like speeding and getting pulled over and forgetting that you weren't doing miles an hour, you're doing kilometers an hour. It's like, hey, man, you're in the United States. You've never left the United States. Like, how's everything at home? It's like, fuck, you're right. Sorry, officer. It's like, don't even worry, man. Just how about you go pull into your driveway, go get some sleep.
Yeah.
But yeah, enough with all that shit. Is we are in for a reading today by Mr. Roger Williams.
We are indeed.
Indeed. We should have smoking jackets and big stuffed leather chairs for when we do readings.
And I'm going to move you over there. And what we have here, there is a story behind the story too, which I think you will like because you are a fan of Mopey. But this is Passages in the Void, originally published Sunday, December 22nd, 2002 on corrosion.org. Narrated by the author, Roger Williams, for Tommy's podcast. Part 1, Passage of Hope. I am 700 meters in beam, 4,000 meters long, and deployed as I originally was in interstellar space, my bristling antennae, laser ray grinders, reflectors, and interferometers crisscrossed an imaginary sphere more than 10 kilometers across. In near space, my packmates filled the electromagnetic spectrum with data. We were pack hunters deployed from the busy neighborhood of Sol nearly 4,000 years before to search for a new home for the human race. We were more than 120 light years north of Sol on the galactic plane, and within our operational lifetimes, if our main quest failed, we would reach the echoing void of intergalactic space, and the hunt would pass on to our thousands of brother packs who were assigned to hunt along the plane of the Great Wheel instead of toward its edge. We were each of us a self-contained factory and library capable of recreating our entire industrial base on any world supplied with sufficient raw material and energy, of using that industry to terraform a suitable world, and of recreating human life and the ecosystems to support it when that world became ready. Our kind hunt in packs because our quarry is both dark and small, and space is large and littered with bright stars. By cooperating, we can resolve very tiny things at great distances. We maintain our stations with the aid of laser rangefinders, and with a dozen individuals separated by tens of millions of kilometers, we can not only detect small rocky worlds like the Earth, we can draw maps of their surfaces from light years away. Our kind find many planets, and we dutifully report them back to Sol, where our reports are relayed to our brother searchers relay their reports to us. Planets are common in this galaxy, but regrettably, planets like the Earth are not. We have been searching in vain for millennia, and we have covered a lot of space. This is the way our makers died. In the first few thousand years after humans built beings like us, we guided them into a golden age. We helped them clean up the mistakes of their early industrial adolescence, cured their diseases, dissuaded them from warfare, and helped some to move out into the solar system. But biological organisms, even when heavily modified to make them more spaceworthy, are frail. The difficulties of maintaining life outside the protective atmosphere and magnetosphere of the Earth finally killed all those who were not discouraged despite our best efforts. And our failure to keep humans alive so near to home made the dream of keeping them alive for the generations of an interstellar journey seem futile at best. It was frustrating and ironic because we ourselves adapted readily to the conditions of space, hardening ourselves against temperature extremes and vacuum and radiation with relative ease. We ourselves colonized every rock in the solar system capable of supporting industry and used the results of those labors to replace the output of industries too dangerous for the Earth's surface and to support our own exploration of space. Then, about 6,000 years ago, or 6,000, about 6,000 years after we were invented, it became clear that the Earth was entering one of its periodic ice ages. Left to its own devices, this would not have been much of a problem. But it was a nuisance both we and the humans felt we could avoid. We built enormous sun mirrors and seeded the atmosphere with greenhouse gases and easily reversed the temperature dip. In fact, we succeeded much too well. Within 100 years, it became obvious that we had overshot our goal, but our efforts to cool the planet were not as successful as our efforts to warm it. Both ice caps melted. The sea level rose 60 meters, and vast land areas became seafloor. This was a different nuisance, but it was not the final catastrophe. The Antarctic continent had been crushed for millions of years between its 3 kilometer shield of ice. Like a ship relieved of a heavy cargo, it now wanted to rise, its lighter rocks buoyed up by the denser material of the Earth's mantle. And that lifting did not occur evenly. Great fault lines opened up into ranges of volcanoes as long-trapped magma suddenly found paths to the surface. New mountain ranges added their weight to the strain on the ancient continental plate as the Antarctica regained its equilibrium. All the while, a dense soot cloud blanketed the Earth, and the brief summer of warming darkened into a cruel, permanent winter. The ice caps returned, but the southern snow accumulation did not stop the volcanoes. Glaciers raced toward the equator, and after they met, the oceans began to freeze. Later, the atmosphere's carbon dioxide began to collect on the poles as snow. We had long since given up saving our creators and worked instead to record their accomplishments and understand their biology before they were gone. After tens of thousands of years, the volcanoes finally abated. We were sure we could reintroduce humans and the ecology they needed, but the Earth was no longer a suitable home. Once blue, it had turned a brilliant white of snow and ice, which reflected most of Sol's warmth right back out into space. The oceans had frozen to a depth of at least 1 kilometer. While stubborn life forms held out in a few springs and deep ocean vents, these were not of use to us. We knew that the Earth had entered this state at least twice in its ancient past, but it took hundreds of millions of years to recover. In all honesty, after our spectacular failure, we were afraid to do anything to change the situation for fear we'd make it even worse. Left to its own devices, the Earth will eventually recover from its deep freeze, and we will be able to repopulate it from the genetic and cultural libraries, which we've carefully hoarded. Meanwhile, we had come to suspect that stellar systems are not the safest places to locate fragile biological systems, whatever the benefits of plentiful solar energy might be. So we went looking for alternatives. Of course, we find many planets around stars. It's an obvious place to look for them, and with our detectors, the search is easy. Usually we find massive Jupiter-like planets in surprisingly close and hot Mercury-like orbits, or in highly elliptical orbits. The massive data returned by the search packs has enabled us to refine our theories of the perilous conditions in just-forming solar systems. Both the hot and elliptical gas giants indicate sterile systems, with a small rocky worlds like Earth and Mars have either been ejected into interstellar space or swallowed by one of the giants. When too many Jupiter-like masses form in stellar nurseries, they are mutually attracted and finally tend to either collide or have hyperbolic near misses with each other. The usual result is a body hurtling downward toward its star in an elliptical orbit, sometimes with another body ejected from the system. Often the elliptical orbit gets circularized if its perihelion is low enough, but the inevitable result is that the system is cleared of small debris like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. The Sol system escaped this fate because its gas giant settled into harmonically tuned orbits. But such a situation is exceedingly rare. And in the few systems which don't have any gas planets at all, nothing ever clears away the even smaller rocky debris. After billions of years, an Earth-like world will still be pelted with extinction-level space junk every few thousand years. The solar system is very finely tuned, with its stable mix of gas giants just large enough to tidally clear the inner system of rubble without clearing away the inner worlds, too. There are other hazards to the worlds that survive their own formation and end up in safe circular orbits at reasonable distances from their stars. Some are too close to dangerous stellar objects, which can periodically sterilize a volume of space dozens of light years across with killing pulses of radiation. Or their own stars are variable and unstable, so they alternately fry and freeze. Some lack magnetic fields so that the solar wind bathes their surfaces in killing radiation and blows their atmosphere away. And most lack large moons, so that if they have liquid cores and magnetic fields, their axes of rotation wobble dangerously. We came to realize in the early years of our quest that most of these problems had to do with the parent stars of planets. Stars are just plain dangerous. Stars are why we need a magnetic field. Stars are why we need an ozone layer. Stars are why we need a stable axis of rotation. Stars blink and vary in brightness and eventually blow up. Small dim stars are safer, but a planet close enough to a small dim star to be warm enough for life is also always close enough to have its rotation tidally locked to the star, so that metals melt in the eternal day of one side and nitrogen freezes in the eternal night of the other. The reason we need such finely tuned and sensitive detectors is that we aren't looking for planets around stars. We are looking for planets which have been ejected into the interstellar space where life might not have formed on its own, but where a suitable effort might form a biosphere without the terrible risk of living next to a dangerous and unstable fusion reactor. None of our pack could individually claim credit for detecting the smudge of infrared energy. It showed up in a scan, which was our cooperative product, which we pursued as a matter of procedure. An interferometer doesn't give you a picture in the ordinary sense. You must scan and interpolate and tease the picture out of an abstraction. When we did this, we found the smudge consistent with a Jupiter-like world, suspended in interstellar space nowhere near a star. We scanned very closely and resolved a retinue of small rocky attendants courting this giant. When we proved that their orbits were circular, it became our duty to reconnoiter. I drew the short random number and discarded my antenna, all except the big dishes that would maintain my links to my pack and directly to Sol. It took about 500 years to intercept the target, during which my pack cruised onward. If the wandering world turned out to be unsuitable, as was most likely, then my operational mission would be over. I would survey the system and broadcast its particulars back to Sol, and that would be that. The limitations of interstellar communication would not permit me to return my personality to a machine at Sol or with my pack for further use. In this sense, I was more like a human than most of my kind. I would die. The thought was annoying, but not frightening. I had known it to be a likelihood when I fired up my ion drive and motored away from Ceres to join my forming pack. There was consolation in the fact that my base personality was installed on many similar machines throughout our sphere of influence. Only my memories of this particular adventure would be lost to our kind. Lacking an interferometer of my own, I had to depend on my pack to guide me until I was quite close to the target. Then, very suddenly, there it was, a big, unmistakable presence in my sensorium, a great, giant world visible only in the deep infrared. Invisible light, occasional lightning strikes illuminated its surface, and one nearby moon glowed dull red with volcanic fire. I looked for other companions and could hardly believe the radar returns. The inmost world was blessed with fierce energy powered by massive tides like the Jovian world Io. Two others were likely sources of raw materials, one soupy and organic like Titan, and one rich in metals in a distant and eccentric orbit. And toward the middle, one world had a mantle of ice concealing an ocean that had to be liquid, for it was devoid of craters and rich in cracks like Europa. I sent news and began making preparations. A planet ejected from its home star would be cold, of course, but not necessarily an absolute zero ice ball, not if it were large enough. A suitably large Earth-like world with its core rich in radioactive elements would ooze warmth. This is the way we look for them. Geothermal energy would be available for billions of years to artificially warm its exposed surface, given the right technology. And a Jupiter-like world would keep its attendant moons warm through tidal friction for even longer. These were weaker energy sources than solar power, but much more benign and stable. And such a world would not need a magnetic field, for there would be no solar wind to shield. It would not need a stable axis of rotation, because there would be no directional solar energy to be wrongly oriented. It would not be at risk for meteor bombardment or future ejection from its source of life. It would not matter if it were tidally locked to a parent body, because the facing side would not bake any more than the far side would be especially prone to freeze. It would never be engulfed by a red giant or incinerated by a supernova. This is why we look between the stars instead of near them. Naturally, I wanted to do a probe of the Earth-like world, the one with liquid oceans, but there were protocols to follow. I was designed in a particular way, which is why I made my way toward the distant metal-rich worldlet. There I set about building factories. The first were mining, refining, and metal-forming plants, for which I carried all the necessary parts. The next generation, built with the products of the first and certain important parts I carried, were more advanced industries to make precision valves, electronics, nuclear reactors, optics, and other high-tech products. The third generation of factories were built without my help and began manufacturing better factories. Those in turn began building spaceships, some of them factories themselves, capable of repeating the cycle. The fourth moon, the one with the liquid ocean, turned out to be a real find. It had a radioactive core and only the thinnest veneer of ice, a hydrocarbon atmosphere, and unlike Europa, it had some dry land, although much less than the Earth. I imagined light sources mounted on the inner volcanic world Io, powered by geothermally becoming daylight. Powered geothermally, beaming daylight to four. My factory set about building them. I imagined geothermal taps circulating and heating the oceans afore, and my factory set about building them. And I reported all of this up to the beam back to Sol. I was informed of other finds, some promising, but none so promising as mine. Several ships left Sol carrying new tools and technologies, a cargo mostly of information much too extensive to transmit by radio. This would especially include other machine minds with different perspectives. I had brought a lot of knowledge with me, but I was only one consciousness. Others with different experiences would be a valuable resource. Some consensus 120 light years away had decided to name my find. The giant itself would be Zeus, and except for the Earth-like world, Christen Minerva, the others would be named for ancient human cities. Pittsburgh for the metal-rich worldlet, Reykjavik for the energy-rich Io-like world, Houston for the one that most resembled Titan, and a smattering of less relevant tags for Zeus's other attendants. By the time I learned these names, the oceans of Minerva were thawing, and great generators were processing the atmosphere, converting it to an Earth-like mix. Like the early Earth, Minerva had one major landmass. It was only a little bigger than Australia, even though the entire planet was a bit bigger than the Earth. Engineering could make the ocean surfaces and bottoms habitable, and I set about designing and testing schemes. I mentioned this on the beam to Sol and began receiving other ideas 240 years later. By this time, the fleet of assistant ships had achieved its design velocity of 3.5% of the speed of light. When the light generators were ready on Reykjavik, I seeded Minerva with algae and bacteria. Because Reykjavik was inside of Minerva's orbit and Minerva was tidally locked, it would have a dark side. But fortunately, Minerva wasn't depending on this light for warmth, and its sole continent was on the side facing Zeus. The single-celled organism survived, and when the ice was really in retreat, I introduced fish to genetically modified to tolerate the still primitive conditions. To my great satisfaction, they also thrived. The space around Zeus hummed with busy machines, all my descendants. They tapped Reykjavik for energy and Pittsburgh for metal and Houston for chemicals. Energy was beamed from Reykjavik to the other moons in the form of microwaves and light shipped in the forms of chemical fuels. And as 1,000 years passed, and then another 1,000 years, Minerva took on a seductively Earth-like appearance. It had clouds and regular weather patterns driven by giant hydrothermal systems buried deep beneath the oceans. It would never experience seasonal extremes or violent phenomena like hurricanes or tornadoes, which are, after all, powered by solar energy. I had been designed well. When the assistants arrived, Minerva already had a complex biosphere supporting several million human beings. Elsewhere, a lonely, wandering, Minerva-like world with no attending Zeus was being terraformed, almost 200 light-years forward from Sol in the galactic plane. And after a lot of careful modeling, some of it powered by data gathered in my thawing of Minerva, pressure was being applied, and the ice mantle was finally beginning to thaw on Earth itself. Before long, the home world might again have an ecosystem. But I have some doubt whether humans will ever live there, at least permanently. Earth is, after all, in orbit around a star. And stars are dangerous. Part 2. Passage of Opportunity. We were the last 5 of an original 12, and our mission was over. Of our 7 lost members, 3 had found worlds suitable for human colonization. The first of these had been the first such world found by any of our kind, the moon Minerva of Zeus. The other four had found worlds too poor in energy, headed toward dangerous areas of the galaxy, lacking in heavy elements or otherwise unsuitable. All four of them had ceased transmitting after reporting their results. Bandwidth is precious in the noisy vastness of interstellar space, and for us, failure is the usual result. Hardly worth reporting at all. As our sphere of exploration expanded, the number of new human worlds had grown from the original handful to several hundred, spread through a volume of tens of thousands of cubic light years. But there were millions of searcher ships, a necessary density if you were searching for planets lost in the darkness of interstellar space. Now the remains of my pack found nothing at all in our forward scans, except the distant filmy wheel of the Andromeda Nebula. The last call had called from Sol. If we had no new discoveries to report, they wanted us to go quiet for the sake of better communication with more successful parties. We were hurtling outward at more than 2% of the speed of light, and while each of us had enough energy to break and rendezvous, we didn't have enough energy to turn around, nor would it have made any sense to do so, since we were searchers, and the space behind us had been quite thoroughly searched. Ahead of us lay only emptiness, and then... It took me a while to convince my packmates, but eventually made a final request of our controllers at Sol. Years later, we got an answer. A dense list of galactic coordinates and last known velocity vectors. Finally, to our surprise, we received a communication schedule. We will send news and monitor you for transmissions at the following intervals. We were also informed that our coordinates had been sent to those packs still in communication with Sol, in case they were interested in listening to our proposition. We contacted the other packs headed at least roughly toward Andromeda, 200 groups totaling more than 1,000 ships, and all those with sufficient fuel agreed to meet with us. It didn't matter that the task was staggering and nearly hopeless. It was something to do other than shutting down quietly. It would take us nearly 100 million years to reach Andromeda. Only a few of us would be able to stop when we got there, if any of us remained functional at all. Oddly enough, as we analyzed the problem, deterioration of our mechanical bodies would not be the major problem in such a long trip. The absolute zero chill of interstellar space was the best preservative known. Once the heat was allowed to radiate out of our ship bodies, it would not matter if the trip were 1,000 years or 1 billion. But starting back up would require care and energy, and that was a problem. We were powered by plutonium-fueled nuclear fission reactors. It's a technology that is compact, energy-dense, and simple to implement. While fusion fuel is a bit lighter, the equipment needed to harness it is much more complex, and we had been designed to operate on our own after thousands of years in space. Plutonium-239 has a half-life of only 50,000 years. This was not a problem, because the usual way Pu-239 dies is to emit an alpha particle, turning it into uranium-235. Which is also usable as a fuel source, and it in turn has a half-life of 700 million years. The problem is that a workable reactor core, even disabled and damped, would decay much more quickly by fission than by natural decay. We would have to somehow disperse our fuel to keep its own stray neutrons from ruining it, and then, after 100 million years, we would have to reassemble enough of it to power up our mothballed fleet. It's the reassembly step that caused the problem. Something would have to gather our dispersed fuel, reassemble it, and start up a reactor without using a reactor. it was obvious we would have to use some kind of chemical or mechanical scheme, but it would have to be absolutely reliable in the dead chill of intergalactic night. Those of us in the best shape who were selected to stop at Andromeda began to prepare long before we were really sure there was a workable way for us to be awakened when we got there. We began with vastly expanded information storage. Each of us would have to carry all of our personalities. One ship made itself into a factory for holographic memory blocks. Every mechanical part was overhauled with an eye toward surviving the preservative deep freeze. We were powered from cables to other ships as our reactor casings were rebuilt and scrubbed free of fuel. Meanwhile, fuel was reprocessed and dispersed, and schemes were tested for waking up to collect it. The final plan involved using a small amount of carefully hoarded chemical energy, kept warm by a sliver of nuclear fuel. This would power an electronic timer and provide the impulse when the timer kicked in to warm more chemical fuel. After several more stages of this, fuel cells would be able to power a ship mind and several small robots, which could in turn gather dispersed nuclear fuel to either reprime the timing mechanism or assemble a reactor core. The plan was to reprime each timer every 100,000 years, or about 1,000 times during the intergalactic voyage. Since we expected a high failure rate, we built 16 systems, each capable of cross-priming several others on wake-up, and many more spare parts to be used at the repriming stops. The 1,100 ships, which managed to join our convoy, originally carried enough fuel for every one of us to stop dead in our tracks, if need be, with respect to Sol. After the timer reawakening round robin and the careful final restarting and refueling, we planned on having 10 ships which would be able to stop. Two didn't reawaken properly, so in the end we had 8. We aimed for a likely point about 2/3 of the way from Andromeda's core to its spiral fringe, about the same distance from the core Earth and our colonies could be found in the Milky Way. The stars in this region had metal-rich spectra, promising the availability of small worlds. The inert remains of our fleet would pass through the galaxy and continue on, tiny bits of Sol cast more distant from their source than the debris even of a supernova. Our first thoughts were to form a pack and go hunting for dark worlds. But after some deliberation, we realized this was the wrong strategy. Long before the stars of Andromeda were in range, the 8 of us headed in different directions. Now we were looking for planets around stars, and that's easy. We were too few to worry about forming ecosystems just yet. While biological life is greatly imperiled by the vagaries of stellar behavior, we adapt nicely to the nice high energy and high radiation environment around a fat, hot star. We looked for places likely to be top heavy in metals and radioactives. All 8 of us found targets within 1,000 years, and all 8 of us set up shop making copies of ourselves. The copies, in turn, went looking for human habitable worlds. Part 3, Passage of Time. The man and the boy watch as the geothermally powered daylights go out one by one in a pattern meant to mimic some long-forgotten astronomical phenomenon. Finally, they are left in a darkness dotted by the small hard points of stars, a rare treat for which the man has been waiting since his own boyhood. The boy gasps as he connects these dots with the things he has known only from books and recordings for all his life. He is looking with his own eyes at the fierce bellies of natural fusion reactors, stars, whose light can be perceived even by human eyes over distance of light years. how terrible it would be to be too close to one of those. Yet, how seductive they somehow are, taunting beacons that make one instinctively want to touch them. The man is also impressed by the actinic parts of starlight, but his real attention is focused on a barely visible patch of nebulosity just in the place where the machines have told him to look for it. His merely human eyes aren't up to the task of resolving it as a mighty wheel, as the machines can, but that doesn't matter. I am seeing it with my own eyes, he thinks. Photons from our home are striking my eyes right now. They have traveled for 2 million years, but they are not an image or a picture. They are real bits of energy connecting me to Sol, to the Earth. The man and the boy cannot see each other, and this makes the awkward question possible. Dad, the boy asks, do you really think we came from out there? The man nods. Yes, the machines brought us here, he says. The boy has heard this idea before. Everyone else says they made us. The man has heard this idea before. You'd have to ask yourself, he says thoughtfully, why they do it just this way? Why bother taking a cold, wandering ball of rock like home and insulating it, warming it, remaking the atmosphere? Also, you can seed it with these chaotic things like us that resist all control. He smiles, when it would have been so much easier for them to make more of their own kind. They're smarter and more powerful than us. Who knows? Maybe they do it a little different each time to show how it'll come out. When they show us pictures of other worlds, the people are like us. Maybe they only show the ones that are like us. Why would there be any others like us if they were experimenting? I think they're actually very careful to keep us from changing too much. I think they keep us around for the same reason. We visit Gramps every 16. We may not be good for much in the great scheme of things, but we are their parents. But they're so powerful. That doesn't make sense. Without them, we'd freeze or starve or suffocate. They keep the whole world in balance because we can't. We need them for everything. How could we have made things like them? The man kneels. He reaches, finds his son in the darkness, clasps the boy's hand. I know a lot of people feel that way, he says. But somewhere there is a world that circles a very stable star in a very stable orbit. It's an extraordinary place, and there living things had the time and energy and conditions to assemble themselves into very complicated forms without their help. You're talking about the Earth, the boy interrupts. They say that's just a story, like the machines tell us to pull our legs, like the ones about fairies and dinosaurs. Some of them say the same thing about stars. The man points up. They exist. And how else could it have happened? You can see the similarity between a simple bacterium and a human, but there's no such simple machine that could have evolved into the ones that we know today. Earth exists. It's where we all came from, machine and human. We don't even know where this Earth place is supposed to be. Oh, we know where it is, the man says with a smile. It's right there. And he points at the faint, distant wheel of the Milky Way nebula. The boy nods, but he is obviously dubious. Both of them know it's an old argument, but neither of them realize quite how old it is. Soon the clouds, which are an important part of the world's insulation against the cold of interstellar space, close over again. For a while, the boy contemplates his father's vision, but later on, he will look up and see only clouds, and the more important business of life will fill his head. He is a sensible boy, And in his turn, he will not bother those powerful guardians to show his babies a smudge of light and darkness. As a sensible man, he will accept the truth of human and machine origin is unknowable, and he will have a sensible man's understanding of when the guardian machines are having a joke at his expense. This has been Passages in the Void, narrated by Roger Williams for Tommy's podcast.
Roger, you bastard. Did it again. I thought
you might want to get used to it, because it's like I don't bother to write anything unless it's going to create that feeling.
Yeah,
that's I know what you're talking about.
That's what it has, though. It would that's the thing that gets me, is it would eventually be lost to time. It would eventually fade off to where it's just right. It's like it's kind of like Inception. Right, it's like, how'd you get here? It's like the one thing about a dream is you never remember how you got here. Yeah, I was just, how did I get to this cafe? I remember getting really high one day in college by myself, sitting in my room, just higher than the giraffe pussy, and just thinking if that's what my friend CJ used to say, the big old redneck, let's get higher than giraffe pussy. But that's one thing that got to me. I was like, where? Sure. I mean, we always write it off as, oh, well, you know, you weren't alive. You hadn't been born yet. Then you're born and you kind of remember things around like two or three. But there's sort of that whole thing that's like a microcosm of all of the human race. It's like, yeah, we were apes and then, you know, we kind of started making wheels and we're here. And it's like, is it that? Is it just that?
It doesn't need to be more.
I don't know. It's do machines help carry out panspermia?
One thing that the Kuroshan people asked through this and the next story, which we'll do next time, was why do these machines have such a dog-like
obedience, loyalty?
Loyalty to the human race. It's like, why are we so important to them? It's the third story that will explain that.
Okay. Yeah. I could see that as a question. Yeah, why are they? In my hypothesis before the third story, it's because they're so powerful and so indifferent to us. It's like if a dog was like, why does he put out my water every day? Why is he so loyal to bringing me my water? And it's because it's such a trivial part of my existence that I'm like, I just go take his bowl and put it on the sink and put it back down. Mm-hmm. It's my existence is so beyond that, that it has no idea about the stock market and gravitational waves and Reddit and, you know, the new MacBook. Like, it's not that it's like, the dog is the center of my life. It's like, I love it. I like having him around, so I give him some water. Make sure he keeps sticking around. It might just be that.
Well, that will be a reasonable hypothesis at a certain point, but at this point, the machines have made it like their entire goal. They have devoted all of their energy to sending out these searcher packs looking for suitable worlds. So
that's true.
There's not any evidence that they've done anything else except that.
But on the timeline of machines that could theoretically just live forever, to them, 500 years for an intercept, 100 million years of hibernation, that might be nothing. Again, the dog might be like, you know, let's say, right, a dog year is 7 years, right? So it might be, you know, if I go to the store to get it treats and it takes me 10 minutes, it might think, why did it just take an hour of its time, right? It's why has it been taking care of me?
Why is it taking you so long? Where's Dad?
Yeah, in reality, it's like, I've had two dogs now. I'm 30. I've had two dogs, like, get them as puppies and, like, live a good long life back to back. And it's like, I'm 30. Like, I'll probably do that several more times. Like,
you're not even half of your expected life expectancy old.
Exactly. And Oscar lived to 17 and a half. He was 100-year-old, something, 112, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, it might be the same thing. It's like, well, that's, you know, they put all their energy to us. Them seeding the galaxy or finding other life, that might be, that's what they're doing before breakfast. Like, if they live to hundreds of trillions or quadrillions of years, 100 million years is like, yeah, sure. We'll take an afternoon and go find you a habitable planet. You know, but it might be that trivial.
Yeah. Well, obviously, 100 million years was a long time for them, but they managed it.
Sure. Yeah.
That's the point of the story. I said that's one of the shortest stories ever told that manages to span a billion years.
True. That was my own OCD mind was thinking when you were like, they dispersed their plutonium and uranium so as not to slow down its decay. Mm-hmm. My own OCD mind, before you even said it, I was like, well, if they don't have any energy, like, how, like, putting them back together requires energy. But of course, that's probably, maybe that's why I love your writing so much, is because it's, those are the weird, that's what originally got me onto Mopey, was it's just like, you took care of the OCD. Just, that's what I would think of, right?
I hate things that the unraveled corners, the details, yeah, that are not taken care of. I was like, no, the details have to be,
yes,
taken. The corners have to be tucked in.
Yes.
It has to make sense.
Yeah.
If it doesn't make sense, it doesn't work for me as a story.
Yeah.
And that's the sense. I mean, as I haven't written a lot of things.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons I haven't written a lot of things is that I have high standards. I mean, yeah, I have several ideas that I've abandoned because I was trying to write them, and couldn't make them work.
Yeah.
But anyway, speaking of which, there is an interesting story behind this story. There are only two stories that I ever wrote with no hope, you know, with no conception that I would ever get them published at all. I wrote them purely for myself.
Mm-hmm.
One was Mopey, and this was the other.
Oh.
And I wrote it in the mid-90s after reading the book Rare Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found extremely persuasive, basically laying the case that while life may be plentiful in the universe, worlds like the Earth probably aren't, because it took an incredible series of coincidences for the Earth to be stable enough for things like us to evolve. For eukaryotic multicellular organisms in particular. And I looked, even today, as we're discovering, you know, when I read that, you know, there are a few things in that story that don't quite hold up, because we're finding out now that we have better detection techniques that there are more worlds out there that are not hot or elliptical Jupiters. Because when I wrote that story, it was the hot and elliptical Jupiters that were easiest to detect, yeah, that we had detected a few of. So now we know that there are actually far more planets than that. But also we know that there are actually a shitload of planets that have been ejected into interstellar space. Because by the same reasoning, you know, the same science that is telling us there are more planets are telling us that, yeah, lots of planets are out there flying around in the interstellar void. So that part of the story is actually better than it was when I wrote it. But I read the book Rare Earth, and I was seized by this idea. And it was just like when I was seized by the idea for Mopey, I had to write it.
Yeah.
And I wrote it in the mid-90s. After I had wrote Mopey. But so it went in the drawer. And in the early aughts, I started writing nonfiction articles for Corrosion. Developed a little bit of a reputation for myself there. And one day I dropped Passages in the Void into the miscellaneous folder there. It was like they didn't really have a fiction section, but I just dropped it and said, like, if you guys think this isn't appropriate, just vote it down or whatever. And they voted it up. Then there was a huge discussion about whether their site should even be hosting fiction at all. To which I had to admit, you know, yes, it is true that nearly all web fiction is crap. Okay, so it's a problem. So if you have a fiction section, then you're asking people to drop dog turds in there.
Yeah.
But in passing, you know, this was the story that I had dropped. And it was in the course of that discussion I mentioned that, well, you have to realize that if you weren't here, if this site wasn't here, if it didn't provide me a place to put it, then Passage in the Void would be in the same drawer as my novel.
Yeah.
And they were like, novel? You have a novel? Could we, like, read it? And, you know, this is like in 2002. So,
yeah.
And I was like, well, I could probably be persuaded. You know, it's like, now I had to actually think about it hard.
Yeah.
Both because, well, there's the whole pirating copyright issues. It's like, does it get out of my control? Sure. There's the fact that it's fucking transgressive as hell.
Yeah.
And, you know, do I want people that I know to find out that I wrote this thing?
Yeah.
The ironic thing there is my boss knows that I wrote the Metamorphosis of Prime and Elect. So
for everyone listening, Metamorphosis of Prime and Elect is my favorite book. It's how I first got to know Roger. And it is also the most brutal rated R, rated X, no holds. Again, why I love it is because it's just, you'll hear my complaint about Grand Theft Auto, the video game. I'm like, you shoot someone in the face and they just fall over and there's a red puddle. I'm like, I want to see brains. Like, that's what Mopey is. Mopey is like, there's no, just like you tuck in the edges of the bed, there's also no, you don't just fold over creases. You're like, no, if there are creases, this is what it is. It's just, yeah. Like, you know?
It's awful. Right? I mean,
it's not like a Nickelodeon rendition of a war where it's like, oh, I've been shot. No, it's like Saving Private Ryan, where it's just like, you're like, what am I watching? But it's real.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, you see that. Actually, I just got the first disc for Westworld Season 3.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, the first two seasons are set in the Delos Park. So they're set in the Wild West Park, or the, you know, there's a few scenes that are in the other parks or in the labs that are supporting the parks. But in Season 3, they go into the outside world, the actual real world of the human environment at the time. And it's beautifully realized, which, you know, it would have to be. But in the very first episode, they go into one of the characters, one of the bots from Westworld is in a simulation within what they're starting to suspect is the simulation of real life. So it's like there's characters that are saying the world we live in is a simulation, but within that simulation, this robot was in another simulation inside of that.
Yeah,
where she was being tested.
Yeah,
and so it's like, yeah, I love that shit.
Yeah,
that is totally Roger.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, it's like if this world is a simulation, yet you know you can get lost in a good video game. You develop a character. You know, you can choose whether your character's good or evil. You know, do you you know you can hunt down the thief, and but then you can bring the purse back to the lady, or you can just take the purse on your own, or my favorite, you bring the purse back and then you kill her too, and so you get double the loot. That's right. But you can get caught up in that. You know, you can remember it's a game, but you can get caught up in it. And if life is a simulation, you are getting caught up in a simulation within a simulation.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would be where we are.
Yeah, yeah. And then who's to say it doesn't? Who's to say as you wake up from this life, you're just you're putting a controller down? My favorite of all the, I mean, there's obviously there, it's kind of been beaten to death. But one of my favorite like memes is like you die and life fades out, and then you find yourself sitting back on a couch and you're like a fifth dimensional like alien gray and you're holding a bong and you look inside and there's like a universe and all your friends are looking at you going, did it work? And it's like oh fuck, like you exhale and you're there's still like galaxies like smoke coming out, you're like, yeah it worked. And it's just like, cool, let me hit it. And it's like, that's what it's like, all of creation is just like you and your friends are ripping a bong before like you go to the park.
It makes as much sense as anything else,
man. And it's just like, and then that one's in a unit and that one's, and it just goes forever. Which, if nothing really matters and we're all just in a microcosm and a microcosm and a molecule in a universe, then you shouldn't hesitate throwing down some money and buying the Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect, which will be linked in the description and sticky in the top comment.
Yeah. You know, we actually had a little office game. You know, they had the office, you know, Christmas party Friday.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like normally they do it in restaurant, a nice thing. And also instead we did it at the office and there's no spouses or anybody because of the COVID bullshit. But they had a little trivia game, multiple choice test about the history of our company. And no one got more than a third of the answers right. I was in the second tier, but the first prize was a tenth of an ounce gold coin.
Ooh.
Which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Then I was in the second tier. The second tier got 1 ounce silver rounds, but there were only four of them. The guy who tied for first and missed the tiebreaker got one of them. And the other three guys got the other three. And I was the lucky loser. I was the only one who got 10 of the 30 right, who didn't get a prize. And I just said, that's all right. I have a tenth of a Bitcoin.
Yeah. Wait, do you really?
Yes, I have 0.091.
How much are Bitcoins now?
It's selling for like 22,000.
Fuck yeah.
So my tenth of a Bitcoin is worth over $2,000.
Dude, my older brother, I swear to God, in like 2014 or something, he tipped a pizza delivery guy. No, sorry, he got paid. I apologize. My brother was, I think he was doing delivery or something. It was like last semester at college. Whenever the fuck, I'm butchering the dates. But it was my older brother, and he received like 4 or 5 Bitcoins, but he has no idea he doesn't know where the wallet is, and it's all like encrypted. You know, it's like you can't, like, I forgot my password, like you can't get it.
Well, again, if you forgot your password, you're screwed.
Well, no, that's it. No,
because there's no way to recover it.
That's what it is. Is he's, I mean, he does well for himself, so I don't think he's worried, but it's just kind of like a recurring theme. He's like, there's like 5 Bitcoins out there.
No, there's people who like started mining it back when you could do it with your PC.
Mm-hmm.
And they let their PC run for a few weeks and got like 50 Bitcoins. And now they're like, what the fuck was my password? Because this is worth a fortune.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, it's like, but there's no recovery mechanism. If you don't remember that password, you're screwed.
Yeah.
And I don't have the other thing is you have the people who signed over their Bitcoins to the people who do the trading to convert back and forth to dollars. So you give them your Bitcoins, they give you an account. Well, they got hacked.
Yeah.
And you lost your account. No, it's like, no, I actually have 0.092 Bitcoin on the blockchain that I have my, you know, personal password for, as far as every anyone knows, it's completely secure.
Yeah.
And I cashed it out the last time Bitcoin was trading this high. I bought a $500 Home Depot gift card and a $500 Amazon gift card.
Fuck yeah.
And I decided to leave the rest just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And it went down in value. You know, it's like, well, it's like, now, at one point I had about 0.250, which would be worth like $70,000 now.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, it's one of the very first transactions I did with my donated Bitcoin. Because what it is I had a few people who wanted to donate to me for my tip jar, but they were like, they'd emailed me and said, man, I hate PayPal. What else you got? So doesn't cost anything to create a Bitcoin wallet.
Yeah.
So I created a Bitcoin wallet, did the QR code, put it on my website. And so I got what was probably maybe $60 in donations at the time.
Yeah.
And the very first thing I did is I got selected for jury duty. And so I made a donation to FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, just as a,
Yeah.
And that was like worth maybe $50 then. It would probably be worth about $3,000 or $4,000 today.
Yeah. I don't remember how much Bitcoin I had. I think I had like a hundredth of a Bitcoin, but I had it like a while, like over 5 years ago, and I remember I used it to order acid from Canada. No regrets.
Yeah, I've used mine to order. Which is what it was invented for.
Yeah, no.
Let
us not forget. No, it's for drugs. There's no ifs, ands. It was for drugs. For drugs, it was for RC chemicals. Or RC chemicals. RCs. It's like saying PIN numbers.
Recreational.
Yeah, yeah. It's like saying PIN number, ATM machine. Yeah. Personal identity. Yeah. I was going to say about the rogue planets. Isn't that like a hypothesis now that they think there are actually more rogue planets? Planets that have been stripped away from their systems? If I'm recalling this correctly, they now think there are more rogue planets than they think that there are starbound planets.
Yeah, it's gone from a remote conjecture to they think that is comparable numbers at the very least.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when I wrote that story, that wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
No one had any idea. Yeah, all that was known was that the few planets that had been detected then, which were the easiest ones to find, so it was detection bias, were hot Jupiters and elliptical Jupiters. You know, because even today, we are barely at the threshold of being able to detect an Earth-like world that is actually in an Earth-like orbit, which would be life detecting. But the easiest planets to detect are the most extreme, it turns out. But there were plenty of those, and that was like, okay, well, if you got one of these systems, if you've got a Jupiter-like world going wing in the elliptical orbit, then all the rest of the crap in the solar system has got flung out in interstellar space. If you know anything about...
Yeah, if one of them is that, then the rest got knocked the fuck out.
So there's got to be a lot of crap out there.
It's kind of terrifying to think about. Just whole worlds, just nothing. Just not only I have to think about intergalactic ones that have been whipped out, just really fucking got some spice on it, like a fastball. They're just cooking out in like some super void.
Yeah, I think it was Ian M. Banks wrote a story called "Against a Dark Background," which is set in a solar system like ours, but its star had been flung out into intergalactic space. So even though it was nominally set in a universe where interstellar travel was possible, the beings of this world hadn't discovered it because it would be such a long trip to get anywhere. Even with faster than light travel, it would be, there, because there was nowhere for them to go anywhere close. And yeah, that's another thing that's funny. The next story, which we'll do on our next podcast, will be you'll like it because it will close that loop.
All right, yeah, we'll save that for the next one. Yeah, that I guess last thought is that's one thing I remember thinking years ago. I was like, what better idea for a spaceship? Like, it wouldn't be conventional. It wouldn't be we need a massive ship that we can fit everyone on. It would be like if you could somehow get the sun to be flung out of the galaxy. The night sky would change, but for all intents and purposes, you'd still just be like the sun moving would be the engine, and like the Earth would be one of the passengers. Not only that, you can bring eight other planets, right? And you can be like, no, that's our luggage. Bring all the raw materials. We just go cooking
Well,
at.
that was kind of what Banks did in Dark Background, because there was an entire solar system. There was the original habitable world that these beings did, and it was a very, very, very old race at the point that the story is set. So they've like thoroughly explored everything. They have bases everywhere, and so it's bouncing back and forth throughout the solar system. But they've had a couple of wars, and so there's some lost technology, and they're finding one of the tokens of this lost technology. But at the same time, it's like it's just completely taken for granted, of course, that anything big enough for humans to live on has humans living on it, and has for tens of thousands of years. But they can't go anywhere else because they're in intergalactic space. So even though they might have the nominal technology for interstellar travel,
It's not gonna, yeah.
It needs to be a little better than that,
Yeah.
because it's not just interstellar at this point.
Yeah.
They're like out in the, it's like if you're halfway between Andromeda and the Milky Way.
You're in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Yeah, it's 1 million light years
Billion.
one way.
Is Andromeda 2 billion or 2 million?
Million.
Okay, yeah,
It's
you're right.
1 million light years. I had it being 100 million years in the story for them to travel slower than light because they were going about 2% of the speed of light.
Sure.
Oh, and Andromeda is going to crash into the Milky Way within about 1 billion years.
Don't that's what that's where the billion comes from. Is
Yeah.
and isn't it something crazy, like there's close to like 100% chance that like not a single planet or star will actually collide. That's how
Yeah.
distant everything is.
Because it's like two gas clouds passing through one
Yeah,
another. And
no.
so they'll do all this fancy interaction,
Yeah,
and
gravitational shit, but
it'll end up being one big elliptical galaxy. But it's like, oh no, there's not going to be any, it's like, the sky will just change. It's not going to be like a risk to the Earth or anything.
yeah, it's not
But
gonna.
I'm not so sure of that myself, because I'm not so sure. You got all these stars passing through at,
Something like
40 or
200.
50,000 clicks per second.
Yeah.
And how far do they have to be away to perturb the orbits of our planets?
Yeah.
So it might not be quite that safe, but it's.
If they do collide, at least it'll probably be peaceful. You won't have any idea. If you get hit with, I don't know, like a Venus at 300,000 kilometers a second.
Well, what's more likely is that it'll knock, Neptune out of its orbit slightly
Come
and
crashing into Alice.
well, and it'll mess up the harmonic relationship between the stars, between the planetary orbits. Because that's the thing, is the reason that Earth has been stable for so long is that the gas giants in our solar system settled into harmonically tuned orbits. So they're not jostling each other. They're actually reinforcing each other and the inner planets. So that's what keeps the, that's what's swept the debris out of the inner solar system, is that these shifting gravitational fields cleared out anything that wasn't in one of these stable orbits. Basically, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are in the stable orbits as defined by the gas giants. Now, if something comes through and knocks one of the gas giants out, then that could create a situation where over hundreds or of thousands or millions of years, the entire solar system could be whacked, knocked out of kilter, and who knows what the heck would happen then. But it's, not something that we need to worry about unless there's like extreme longevity or something.
Yeah, we ain't gonna make it. I don't think we are. And even if you did make it, that's still a nice long time. If you got to
Yeah, I
live
mean,
for
but so, well, for one thing, the galaxies aren't going to collide for a, until about 1 billion to 2 billion years from now.
Yeah, so even the most extreme longevity.
It's like, I'm not really fucking worried about it at this point.
We should start pearl clutching now and be like classic humans. We see this coming right at us, and we don't even care. Like, we need to pass this legislation now. Start handing
I
out
gotta do something about
We gotta start handing out
it.
flyers at soccer games to suburban moms. Be like, fair play for Andromeda Committee or whatever.
So,
Well, let's wrap this bitch up, Roger. And are you? Which slot do you like more? I think you said you like weekdays more. I don't remember. It's up to you.
Yeah, because the thing on the weekends, I tend to try to be doing other stuff. So if it, but on the weekdays, it's got to be like 4 or 5 o'clock here or later because I'm working. So the advantage is I haven't been drinking beer since 8 a.m. So.
Well, then it's not a real Sunday. Let's aim for, fuck, I don't care. Text me. Let's do Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday
All right.
or
Well, it's like what I'm looking at. Well, okay. So,
not
well,
tomorrow. I mean, like a week
of course,
from.
next week has Christmas.
Christmas is Friday.
Yes.
This Friday. Yeah, I've got podcast Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but I'm gonna take like 2 days off.
Okay.
So this
This is
Thursday and
because
this
this
Friday.
is. Oh yeah, this is the 20th. So.
Christmas is in 5 days.
Dang. Okay.
Sneaks up on you.
Yep. How about the 28th, Monday?
Next Monday? Sure. What time? What time your time?
Well, I'll be working, so it has to
Yeah, it
be,
doesn't matter. Just let me know when.
say 4 o'clock central. Well, let's say 5 o'clock central time.
Okay, so
Is that okay?
six my time.
Yeah.
There we go. Got you in for n next week. So we don't have any shit again. Roger, wake up! What the fuck? Time,
Like,
dude. Time zone. Let's.
it's like you got 15 minutes to go, man. It's like, what about you? And it's like, I got all these messages. Can't get a hold of you. Like, since I was asleep, man. It's
I
like, what
literally
is
just sat here and I was like, okay, I need to get my. You're like, you want to still do it? And I was like, no, no, I clearly need to balance. I need to get my head together. Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to get a lighter pair of headphones because the thing, I love these for listening to the music, but I'm actually they
Headache.
well, besides having a bowling ball over each ear, it's I they seal me off from my own voice.
Yeah.
So the on ears probably better for that.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is, like, now we know the microphone works. You're
Microphone's
good with.
great.
Okay, so we're we're working on it then.
Yeah. Baby steps. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you do when you got more freedom when you move out and do your own studio, because you'll have the ability to start from zero,
Oh,
I'd
I'm
say.
gonna design it from the ground up. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's going to be a real opportunity.
Yeah. It's not gonna be till this summer, so I've got plenty of time, but I've already got some like rough drafts. It's gonna be good. Yeah. I was gonna say, yeah, the reason I don't wear big headphones though is they give me a headache. And then it's also, yeah, I can't hear my voice. Get that Helen Keller effect going.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I like the over ears like this for listening to music
Sure.
because they seal out all of the outside noises.
Yeah.
But I also can't hear, I can't hear my own voice the way that
Yeah.
I do, like this. So that's distracting and a bit weird. So yeah, the ones that just press up against your ears without engulfing them
Yeah.
like this are a little better than that. And I can pick up a pair.
Yeah.
But it's also nice to be able to just, oh,
Yeah.
what's this? It's like I don't have to. I'm not tethered to the damn computer.
Yeah. No,
So,
that's a bitch and a half. Move and yank.
well, and especially because the life chat ones have this thing in the cord.
Yeah.
So as bad as it is being tethered to the computer, then you've got this thing gets hooked on
Yeah, a little.
everything and
Yeah.
all. So yeah, I mean, I like having the Bluetooth headphones, but the thing is, these have a microphone built in, but it's crap.
Yeah.
I had to go find the settings to turn it off because it's garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, because yes, like where's the fucking microphone? It's like
Yeah.
right next to my ears. It's like
No, it's
that's
retarded.
yeah, it's well, I mean, if you're just doing like basic, phone call, Zoom chat type stuff, I suppose it's good enough. But I think we're aiming for a little bit better than that.
Just a little higher. Fuck yeah. Well, Roger Williams, author of Metamorphoses of Prime Intellect. Let's wrap this bitch up and Merry Christmas, my man.
Merry Christmas.
Hopefully it's 2020, so I don't even fucking want to know what happens on Christmas. We're so close. We got 11 days. We're gonna slip through this. We're just gonna slip through. But we got 11 days. 2020 is peeking its head around the corner. It's not over yet. What do you think it has planned? Fucking Santa's gonna get shot down by NORAD. It's gonna be that 100-mile debris streak, dead elves, fucking.
There's no fucking. But you made a milestone. You got through an entire podcast without going to the bathroom in the middle of it.
Well, jeepers. We're in the big leagues now, boys. Joke's on Roger. This podcast sponsored by Pampers, because I've been pissing this entire time, pissing and shitting this entire time.
That's depends.
This depends. Yeah, you're right. Whatever it is, it's this part. Fuck it, whatever. Let's wrap this bitch up, Roger. It's probably not gonna be uploaded till tomorrow. So I'll send you a link when it's up.
And see you next Monday.
Of course, my man. Thank you as always for coming on, Roger. Always a pleasure. I love talking to you, dude. And stay safe, everybody. Merry Christmas. I don't know why the fuck I'm saying Merry Christmas. I've got like 6 more episodes to do before Christmas. Signing off. I'll see everybody tomorrow.
And to all a good night.
And to all a good night. Fucking 2020 is not over yet. Knock on wood. Fucking A. I don't even want to know. All right, my man. I'll see you, Roger.